Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, what does Antonio Conte need to do to turn Tottenham into challengers? Will that ever happen? We'll also talk about Thomas Tuchel's Chelsea as they go to Manchester City in a top of the table clash. We'll hear what Cristiano Ronaldo's been saying about Ralf Rangnick and his time back at Manchester United. We'll also discuss the Africa Cup of Nations and more. This is The Game. Hello again, Hugh Wisencroft here alongside Tom Clark, Jonathan Northcroft and Alison Rudd. Alison joining us to discuss what ended up being a pretty one-sided affair over the two legs in the first EFL Cup semi-final. Chelsea beating Spurs 3-0 on aggregate. By the way, 350 days since Thomas Tuchel's first game in charge at Chelsea. He's become their first manager ever to take them into a Champions League, FA Cup and EFL Cup final. Alison, firstly, I'm tired of cup teams. Antonio Conte playing a cup team in these two ties when Tottenham haven't won a trophy for so long is disgraceful, frankly. Alison, tell us about the golfing class between Spurs and Chelsea over these two games.
Well, the most telling moment came when Thomas Tuchel berated the team for playing at 90%. And it was a bit of a stroll for Chelsea. And I think that was telling because Spurs were up for it. I get your point about why didn't he play a full strength team, although other than Hugo Lloris, that was the sort of big leave out for the North London derby. I don't think the team was ridiculously weak. They were up for it. Spurs were up for it. They weren't dreadful. I like their attitude. They did not let the various VAR decisions make them ill-tempered or you know, defeatist. But Chelsea just didn't have to do very much. I mean, the 90% stat, I think, was probably quite generous. I would have said 77.3%, really. It needed something miraculous from Spurs, and Chelsea obviously decided to stop a miracle. All you have to do is sort of stroll around a bit and make sure you've got Antonio Rudiger in your team.
Antonio Rudiger could soon be out of their team. Remember, of course, linked with several clubs, given his contract's up at the end of the season. But if he does want to stay, things are going pretty swimmingly under Tuchel. In the wider context of things, I still think the Premier League title race, we'll discuss it a little bit later on, you know, could end up being a disappointment for Chelsea. But lots of the talk, Alison, has turned towards the size of the job that Antonio Conte now has at Spurs. And I find this very strange, to be perfectly honest, because in my mind, he's been brought to Spurs to turn them into a top four team. The idea that he's meant to be turning them into a Premier League winning side is fantasy. And they aren't far away from being a Champions League qualified team. And he doesn't need that much to get them into fourth place right now. And people keep talking about them tearing the squad apart, selling all the players that they've got because none of them are good enough. And these two games have shown us that. He's not going to, in my opinion, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, he's not going to challenge Manchester City, Chelsea or Liverpool during his time in charge at Spurs. And that's not a defeatist attitude. I mean, the facts and figures in particular stack up in that way for me. What do you think?
I think Daniel Levy is hoping that Conte can weave some sort of spell, some sort of Conte spell on what they've got. I think for quite some time, go back to the early days of Pochettino at Spurs, there's been something there that you feel with the right tweak, the right approach, the right attitude towards the academy, they could make themselves four certainties, regulars, if you like. And it has, you know, it has happened for them. They've come really close to winning the title. And they were in a cup final last season. It feels tantalisingly close. And if it is tantalisingly close, then you're not, as a club, going to want to overhaul, get rid of lots of players, spend big on new players. You're going to feel that it takes one more piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And in this case, they think it might be Antonio Conte, because he's very good at making good players excellent. And just, it might only be for a short time. They might, like, as they did at Chelsea under him, the players got a bit tired of his strict approach, this constant reference to suffering. It's great when you can see it's reaping rewards and then you win something and then you think, okay, we'd like to move on from this now and have some ketchup on our chips, and that's going to happen. But I think even Conte, because I think the narrative is like this, Hugh, because Conte himself is indicating that when he compares what he's got with what the other rivals have got, it's not enough for him. And we've seen a mixture of performances. We've seen performances, I mean, this is what keeps this same narrative going, if you like, because we've seen performances that speak of an ability to push on. And then we've seen performances where B-list players just are not nowhere near good enough. And they haven't got what it takes to even take on board the Conte suffering philosophy. So it's this sort of hodgepodge of what could be, what do you need? And then inevitably you're going to get a conclusion that says money, that's what you need. You need money, you need to spend big, offload, spend big. They've missed the boat, because I don't think Harry Kane will bring in money even if they decided to sell him now. Not as much as they would have got in the summer. So we're in a sort of twilight zone of what could be possible. And, you know, the logical thing to say is, well, Spurs with Conte and a big wad of dosh, he could do something. But as you say, Hugh, that's not what the club do. And I don't think they thought that's what they were getting with Conte either.
Johnny, what do you think? What's the prediction for what Antonio Conte can do, and how in particular?
Yeah, look, I think as Alison's kind of outlined, in some ways the ball is in Tottenham's court, and I'm not sure what they can do with that ball, if that's not extending the metaphor in a weird way. You get Antonio Conte and you are hiring a guy that's intense, addicted to winning, proven track record of winning, will stop at nothing to try and win. But you're hiring him as the sixth or seventh best team in the league. And that's a huge gap, really. And I've had misgivings, I have to say, from the start about whether that marriage would work, because it hasn't taken Conte long to assess the situation, and I think make it quite an accurate call, which is that, reasonable as Spurs are, there is a gulf, there's an enormous gap between them and the top three. Yes, they have been tantalizingly close to winning in the past, but in the last couple of years, I think the top three have just moved to a different place. So that closeness for me is no longer there. And in fact, you could say that Spurs have declined while that top three's gone on. So my question would be, are they really willing, or do they have the resources to really try and bridge that gap? And I have to be honest, part of me wondered whether the sign of Conte was, you know, we can't afford to spend £200 million on players. We can't afford to get this absolutely top manager, and that's the next best thing. But he needs players to work with. And I think he's right to say that squad is nowhere near where Liverpool's or Man City's is or Chelsea's is. There may well be a standoff now, and I don't see Conte hanging around long term if he thinks he's going to be, you know, basically in a fight that he can't win. Not because he's a prima donna, but because of his characteristics. He detests losing. He suffers. You could see last night his kind of visceral despair at not. You know, really coming anywhere near Chelsea over those two legs. And he's not going to stomach too much of that. So, you know, I think the ball is in Paratici and Daniel Levy's court. Are they going to fund this this overhaul to the squad that they need to. And amid all of that, where does Harry Kane come in? Does he become a asset that they sell in order to reinvest, or is he a priority to sort of ensure they keep and build around? So there's a lot of questions for Tottenham. They have got a brilliant manager. They're not hopeless, but they've got a manager that's not going to settle for what maybe the hierarchy would be happy with, which is top four. He's going to want to go all the way. And if he can't, I do not see him hanging around for years in the way Poch did, sort of manfully struggling to, you know, against the odds. I just don't think that's in Conte's makeup.
They host Arsenal, North London Derby, a very important match for the club as well this weekend at Tottenham Hotspur. Tom, where do you think they are going into that game? Are they favourites, or do you think... I feel almost like the mood at both clubs is pretty lower after recent weeks, whether that be injuries, COVID, you know, whatever it might be, results on top of it, of course. We of course, don't know how Arsenal are going to do yet against Liverpool in the EFL Cup semi-final. But it's a huge game for both in terms of that top four picture. You just don't feel either team's really confident.
No, maybe not. As you say, we'll see how Arsenal get on against Liverpool. If they can put in a... I shudder to use this term, sorry Arsenal fans, but spirited performance against a Liverpool side and stay in the tie, then I think in terms of that mood that you're talking about, they'll be in a better place going into this game. Because I think the guys have talked about it there. We're starting to see now with Tottenham the reality of the situation Conte finds himself in. And I think when you look at that team, you know, I appreciate Johnny's analogy about, you know, that, okay, we're not going to spend the money, but let's spend the money on the manager. But actually... when you think about some of the squads they've had, Conte's probably got one of the weakest, particularly if you look at his defence, and I mentioned it on the previous show, the guy likes playing with wing-backs. They've not really got any of significant talent. Find Reggie on when he plays. So I think from that point of view, Tottenham are at a slightly lower ebb, and particularly without having Son, who's probably been their star performer all season, I just think probably it's advantage Arsenal. As long as Arsenal don't get hammered by Liverpool, then they're in the better frame of mind, just because... yes, they got beaten by Nottingham Forest in the cup. Yes, they had a little bit of a dip, but overall, their season has been good. You know, shepherded by manager of the year, Mikel Arteta, of course.
Alisson, just finally, Chelsea, only one win in their last five Premier League games, but they have won the last three matches, all of them, of course, in various cups. Do you think their blip is over for this season?
I would say yes. A lot was made elsewhere of Tuchel's body language in the second leg, and which really surprised me. I mean, it's like if you're at a game and you just watch Thomas Tuchel, that is a very entertaining pastime, by the way, because you know he takes it to a whole new level, gyrating and gesticulating constantly. I've never quite seen any manager like that, and I doubt we ever will again. But you can just fit his body language to whatever theory you have at the time. And so Chelsea have been relatively disappointing of late outside of the cup competitions. And so I've seen references to, oh, you can tell Tuchel's had enough. He's just, you know, so disappointed with what they're doing. And you can tell from his body language that he's not happy. He's at his most angry when they're playing well. There is something very peculiar about how he reacts to a game. It's as though he's showing off that he sees things that we don't. So I've noted that he is particularly sort of almost grotesquely gurning and going down to the floor, and his arms are flailing, and he's sort of just looking like he's in agony. Usually right in the middle of a very good piece of Chelsea approach play, when you think, oh, they're clicking. Because he's obviously... asked them to do a tiny little tweak and they've not done it, or, you know, he wants perfection and so on. So it's a really nice contrast with Conte, who by comparison looked like a statue, really, compared to Tuchel. He's not Conte hasn't got enough to gyrate about, basically. So I feel that Tuchel is totally engaged in the project. As you pointed out, the top Hugh, he's the most successful Chelsea manager ever in terms of speed of getting them to finals. And it was probably a blip caused by many things. time, this injury, COVID, not being entirely sure as a perfectionist what he could and couldn't do because it was out of his control. That's very difficult. But they seem to be coming out of it. And he seems to be integrating well what you might term fringe players at Chelsea, but who would be first team players anywhere else. So I probably would say yes, if it's not like suddenly completely over, it's on its way out, definitely.
Well, we'll be looking ahead to Chelsea's game at Manchester City, a top of the table clash in the Premier League this weekend. We'll do that right at the end of today's episode of the Game Podcast. But Alison Rudd, thank you for joining us. I hope you managed to get back out on the tennis court. You know, this is the real thing the tennis world's been waiting for. Forget the Australian Open. Hopefully you're over your injuries and you're back out there smashing forehand winners.
I'm waiting for my visa, Hugh, so we'll see.
Alison Rudd, thank you very much. Up next on the Game Podcast, we'll talk about Aston Villa, Manchester United, some choice words from Cristiano Ronaldo. We'll look at AFCON, the Africa Cup of Nations, as well as our favourite, well, S-housery, let's call it that. Stay with us on the Game. We are very, very lucky to have been treated to one instalment of Manchester United against Aston Villa this week. And we're getting another this weekend as well. The first, the FA Cup third round clash on Monday evening, ended with a 1-0 win to Manchester United at Old Trafford. However, Villa dominated for large parts, carving United apart like many of their recent performances. Villa just couldn't get a goal in the end. Now, this weekend's game could definitely include two new talents at Villa Park. Philippe Coutinho arriving from Barcelona on loan with an option to buy. Lucadinha leaves Everton. He's written on social media, by the way, sometimes it only takes one person from outside to destroy a beautiful love affair. A little jibe at Rafa Benitez there, but we're focusing in on Steven Gerrard and Ralph Rangnick's teams today. On the game that has gone, by the way, Tom, I think Villa can be seriously encouraged by their performance against Manchester United, although they've already won there once this season. But generally speaking, under Steven Gerrard, it's been very impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Good contest between two mid-table teams, Hugh, I'd say. sorry, forgive me. But I mean it. No, definitely. They were the better team, weren't they? And it was very, very Manchester United-esque to win 1-0 with a goal by Scott McTominay made by Fred. I mean, that's the position they're in at the minute. We obviously defended and did we criticise? I'm not quite sure. But we had sympathy for Dean Smith, didn't we, when he left Villa? Mm. But it is clear now with these signings and with the kind of style and intense type of football that Gerrard is seeming to want to impart on Villa, that, you know, there was a bigger and, as we said at the time, ambitious plan there about this club to take it onto the next level. And we were kind of looking at it in the guise of, oh, this is incredibly harsh, Dean Smith would have kept them up. And maybe it was about something far bigger than that they thought, there's a transfer window coming, we can kick on to the next level. So as much as the football on the pitch is impressive, it's also these signings. You know, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a Villa fan last night, actually, and he said, look, I like Dean Smith as well, but he'd have never persuaded Philippe Coutinho and Lucadinha to come to the club. And that is an element as well. Gerrard has a massive, massive lure, as well as being, you know, seemingly putting on some impressive tactics on the pitch.
What do you think about Villa right now, Johnny? Because I think with these two signings, there are signs that they're taking this assault on Europe, you know, this aim that they said they had, very, very seriously.
They are, and they're beginning to mirror Steven Gerrard's ambition. I was talking about Conte's ambition, you know, and the need for a club to be in sync with a manager's ambition. And I think Villa are showing why he came to the club. They're giving him the chance to kick the squad on. And what strikes me about the bringing in of Coutinho and Lucadinha is, apart from them both being very talented footballers, there's an element of they've been signed in positions where Villa already had decent players. So he's trying to, you know, really create that extra competition and raise standards that way. You know, Buendia had just started to show his potential under Gerrard, and Gerrard brings in Coutinho, which is probably good for both players. In the same way, Matty Target's had a good season, but he brings in Lucadinha. That's an interesting signing, because if you look at Gerrard's Rangers, they were very attacking in the fullback areas. Tavernier scored 19 goals for them last season. So that's going to be part of the imprint. And they have got the potential to join West Ham, I think, as a disruptor under Stevie over the next sort of 18 months, which of course is fantastic for the Premier League. We might not be talking about Villa v Man U as a mid-table clash in 6 months' time because of Villa.
Absolutely. I mean, just very interesting talking about them being a disruptor. I think you could argue that they're already there, Johnny, because when you think about, I think Chelsea and City both went to Villa Park recently in recent months, and I can remember watching the Tuchel and Guardiola post-match interviews, and they talked, yes, there's the common managerial cliche that this is a tough place to go, but you could sense that they really, really meant it, that that was a real battle in both those games. Just coming back to the signings, though, you talked there, Johnny, about them being in positions where they've got players already. And I mean, I particularly agree with you on Matt Target, who I think has had an excellent season. My flip side to that, and this is me just being contrarian, not necessarily standing by this point, is they're not necessarily bang on 10 out of 10 players. Like, Coutinho's at a weird place in his career. He's got things to prove. Dina as well. You know, as much as he wants to make digs about Rafa Benitez, some people could argue this is a sideways move for a guy who was like, I'm throwing my toys out the pram, I want a big move. It's like, all right, mate, you've gone to Aston Villa, would be maybe what some Everton fans are thinking. So there is that thing of where, yes, they're making statement signings, but they're not like 9 out of 10, these guys are going to definitely guaranteed elevate Aston Villa. I don't know. Am I wrong? Do we think these guys are definitely going to take, or are they kind of that 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10 at the minute? I'm fully prepared that in 2 months we're going to be clipping this up after Coutinho's already scored 10 and Deeney's got about 8 assists. But I don't know. To me, they're interesting signings rather than being like, wow, signings.
I don't think you're wrong, Tom. I think the signings that have got inherent flaws, but inherent enormous pluses as well. If I think the signings that basically come down to, can the manager get something out of them? Can the manager add that value that you can see could be added to their games to make them into those 10 out of 10 players? So it's going to come down to Gerrard, but and you know, goodness me, only it's a small sample size really looking at his Rangers reign, but he did improve and get a lot more out of the raw materials he had there, I think, because he's got very good man management skills and he's got an excellent coach in Michael Beale with him. So if he can add, you know, he's got those players and presumably told the board, I can make Philip Coutinho the player he used to be, and I can correct Luca Dina's defensive shortcomings, and we'll get to enjoy that incredible assist record he's got, energy up the flank. Back me and I'll do it for you. And, you know, we'll see. But I think he's shown Gerrard already that he can be the manager to reawaken careers.
I actually think they're very good signings. Mm. Very, very good signings. I think if Tottenham had made these signings, we were talking about Antonio Conte a few moments ago, we'd all be saying, brilliant, what quality they've added to the squad. Mm. Luca Dina is proven in this league, yeah. And he's a quality player with the ball at his feet and his delivery, etc. Philippe Coutinho, if you get a song out of him, is an exceptional player. Like, he can be. Okay, we haven't seen it for a while, and I think that's the risk you're discussing. But does he improve Villa? Well, yeah, let's be honest, he does. If he's out there on the pitch, he is better as a 7 out of 10 than the other players they have in his position, with all due respect to Emi Buendia. So for me, it's a great signing for Aston Villa. And I look at this now, I look at the broader picture across the Premier League. I think it's going to take a huge amount of money to be a top 10 side in the Premier League now. Like, it's getting ridiculous. Everyone wants to be in Europe. You know, you look at the money that Everton has spent to be a bottom half team and you're thinking it can go desperately wrong, but that's the money that you still have to throw at it, and it might not even mean you're a top half side. Because you're looking at Aston Villa, they're going to invest. West Ham United, I'm sure, are going to invest. If they're not going to spend big money, they still invest as shrewdly as they can. You've got Arsenal, they've already spent big money. Tottenham about to. Manchester United do, of course. You know, Wolves maybe not, but again, it's all about shrewd and intelligent recruitment for clubs like that. But you look at the competition now and you think, these clubs, whoever finishes just outside the top seven or eight used to be criticised for missing out on Europe, or the season fell apart and we didn't quite get over the line. And you look at it now and you're like, no, this is the Super League. I mean, this is the quality of the players that are going to keep coming into the league now. And you think that the Premier League sides are about to capitalise on their financial position and their broadcasting deals by having an all-out assault on most of the big clubs in Europe. I mean, all these players coming to the end of their contracts, they're pretty much all coming to England if they're not going to Barcelona or Real Madrid or Bayern Munich. You know, if they, okay, those clubs get the pick of free transfers, obviously, because they're huge and brilliant clubs. Yeah. But other than that, they're coming to the Premier League. And they, you know, Coutinho at Aston Villa. Hello, Aston Villa have got Philippe Coutinho. And we're saying, is he good enough? Come on.
I mean, yeah, I take your point. And I'm sure a lot of Aston Villa fans will have been doing exactly what you've just done to me, Hugh, when I was mentioning that. But I guess that, the Coutinho signing to me just slightly embodies something you were hinting at there, which is the big argument we always come back to, which is what are you going to be as a club? And Villa fans and the board, I just think they're going to have to be slightly cautious about that, because as you say, they could spend this money and they could finish eighth, ninth, and they have to be prepared that that's not a bad season, because I think we've seen it, particularly Everton's a great example of that kind of boom and bust type approach. And you know, Villa, very rich club. So by all accounts, will keep coming.
This is just the Jack Grealish money that they're spending. If you look at the numbers, actually, that signing of Luca Digne was the last of the money. And I think Villa are only 2 million in the red now for this season, transfer-wise, having brought in more than 100 million worth of players. So they're ambitious, because on top of this money, I think that there's still more to come spending-wise from them in the summer.
Yeah, I think that's definitely worth keeping in mind. I guess it's that point, isn't it? You're talking about Grealish. They've lost Grealish, bringing in Coutinho. We brought in Buendia, starting to find a bit of form, but that was never going to be an instant replacement, is it? You can maybe say, without getting too argumentative about it, Coutinho is a good like-for-like replacement for Grealish in terms of creativity alone. Fine, different type of players at different points in their career. So I just mean from that ambition side of things, essentially they're a slightly stronger version of the team that they were last season, with a new manager and a new style of play. And with that maybe comes aspirations and expectations. They need to maybe balance them out a little bit and give Gerrard time, because we don't want to be in a position in a year's time where maybe they've finished 9th, 10th, 11th and we're going, okay, is this guy good enough? Do Villa need a new manager? That would be my only thought, because Hugh makes an excellent point about we're going to be endlessly fascinated by Wolves, West Ham, Brighton, Villa, Leicester, Man United, teams battling around for the mid-table.
Well, let's quickly focus in on Manchester United. Cristiano Ronaldo's been speaking. He says Manchester United should win the league or be second or third. I don't see any other position for Manchester United. In my heart, I don't accept that our mentality be less than being in the top three in the Premier League, in my opinion. He also said that Ralph Rangnick needs time. He said, I think to build up good things, sometimes you have to destroy a few things. So why not? New year, new life. I hope Manchester United can be at the level the fans want. They deserve that. Tom, what do you make of his comments?
The Rangnick stuff, spot on. I mean, I think that particularly the destroy things to make new things, that very much echoes, I think it was the three of us just around the new year mark, we're talking about giving Rangnick time and this being an appointment where he's really going to pull everything apart and start again and build it up, not just on the pitch in terms of recruitment, youth academy, etc, etc. So I think to hear a senior player talk like that is only a good thing for Ralph Rangnick. I think the rest of it is just PR guff, isn't it? Let's be honest, it's absolute nonsense. I mean,
about being in the top three.
Yeah, I mean, come on, it's just not going to happen. I know I was making jokes about them being a mid-table side, but with pulling things apart, you can't have both those things. They don't work in tandem. You can't destroy things to make good things, and whilst destroying them, finish in the top three. That's just not how it works. They're not going to finish in the top three this year. They might, just by the fact that they've got so many quality players, scrape through and nick the fourth place because there's so much competition around them. Maybe, I don't see it personally, but yeah, I think it's a good thing for Rangnick, isn't it? At a moment when they've lost to Wolves, looked unconvincing against Villa, in this very knee-jerk way in which we consume football, people starting to already question his methods, to have a senior player back him and say that he needs time. I also thought it was interesting to read that he'd said he's already done quite a lot of changes. He's already made quite a lot of changes on the pitch. I think that's a good thing for a senior player to be highlighting. But the rest of it's just, you know, PR, the same nonsense that we've heard from Man United players over and over the last few years. We need to give the fans what they want, blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, he's got to say that.
I know he's got to say that. I know he's got to say that. I'm just not going to give him any kind of kudos for it. I think the other part of the quotes about Ranić are the more telling ones. And I think, yeah, but I think as a 36-year-old, I'd be cautious as to whether he's ever going to get that top three finish at Man United, to be honest.
Johnny, what do you think about the strength of what Cristiano Ronaldo's had to say?
I think it was a significant interview in, I suppose, in PR terms, because I know that United have hoped Ronaldo would speak in this way for all pretty much the whole season. You know, he hasn't done much in the way of media, and he is a leader for them, of course, and with his appeal and his status and all that kind of stuff. So it's important backing for Ranić. I think it's an important one for the club at a difficult time in PR terms. And I think it's absolutely right for him to talk about change, backing Ranić and aspiring to something a little bit better than trying to creep into the top four. The most interesting comments, I think, are about young players, where he talks about, you know, when I was 18, I listened to the senior pros and I took it on board, which, by the way, is true. He took a lot of criticism from the senior guys like Ryan Giggs at the time for things like diving and over-elaborating, and he did take it on board and became a better player for it. So I think he can talk like that. But it's interesting that he chose to say that, talking about himself at 18 and then saying, you know, younger players these days, and he's talking generally, not specifically, but, you know, we can start to read into things. Younger players these days need to listen and help themselves and learn as well and do their best for the team. Now, I just wonder if that is what Cristiano Ronaldo has found upon his return to United, a different environment where instead of having sort of strong characters who can take criticism and can maybe put the team first, there's a rather different set of players in that squad who, when things start to go wrong, look for reasons beyond themselves, i.e. the manager's not good enough, or, you know, we don't like the criticism. That's, to me, looked like the story of what's happened since Ranić took over and since all these kind of protective arm has been removed from certain people. And I wonder if that's what Ronaldo was talking about.
Intrigued to see how Manchester United play at Villa Park this weekend, given it will be take two, and they should see, I guess, the error of their ways at home. So Aston Villa will feel very confident, probably favourites going into it. I wonder what changes Rangnick makes, what tweaks there will be to stop them being played through in the way they were at home. We shall see. And listen, if you're enjoying the game podcast, by the way, make sure you rate us, make sure you leave us a review, make sure you subscribe as well. Plenty more to come. AFCON is next.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mali and Tunisia's Africa Cup of Nations game ended in chaos, didn't it? It was absolutely ridiculous. The referee, firstly, tried to give full time when only 85 minutes had passed. He was then told, hold on a minute, it's not even 90. I think he then thought he was told it was 90 because he then ended the game for a second time 4 minutes later with only 89 minutes on the clock. The Tunisia coach, all the technical staff out on the field, confronting the referee, Gianni Sikazwe, after the final whistle had given them a 1-0 defeat in the end, their opening game in AFCON, of course. But then it was even worse. It's hysteria afterwards. 20 minutes later, after the post-match press conferences had begun, the tournament organisers said the game should be played to a conclusion. Tunisia's players were already in their ice baths. They didn't want to come back and play. They'd already warmed down. And so Mali were declared the winners. Now, the second half was ridiculous in any rate. I mean, there were two stoppages for the VAR referee checks that were appalling. There was a drinks break and nine substitutions in the second half. It was all over the place, frankly. It's not a great image for African football, but I have to say, I think some of the reaction to AFCON as a whole almost is as disparaging as the players and coaches were saying in the build-up to this tournament. Johnny, what do you think of all of this? Look, it was an error, and these errors have happened in many tournaments, many times over the years.
Yes, I was there at the day that Graham Paul decided to issue three yellow cards to the same player and not send him off at the World Cup in 2006. So, of course, it happens. And Andre Marina gave an interesting performance last night. I mean, not on this scale, but let's face it. I don't think anyone can sit from a Premier League lens and say that look at all this terrible refereeing around the world when there's plenty to sort out at home. It does sound like an absolutely bizarre one. And I think the ref's got a bit of a checkered history, who's serving a suspension, which was lifted only recently. I've been a bit disappointed by the lack of goals in the tournament.
This is what I want to talk about, Jonathan. This is one thing I do want to talk about, okay?
Yeah.
The quality of football at AFCON so far has been criticised. Several of the big nations really flattered to deceive. You know, people were expecting a lot of them, the likes of Algeria, Ghana, Egypt, not really hitting the heights after their opening matches. Hello, they were all playing a week ago in domestic football. Yeah. There was no 2-week, 3-week build-up. There was no 2 or 3 warm-up games. I looked this up beforehand. Loads of these countries didn't even have one warm-up match. This was their first game together for many months. The last time some of them played was the international break back in November. Okay, so they haven't really gelled and they haven't had time on the training pitch to gel. So the idea, you know, that they're just going to rock up and play brilliantly and provide us with loads of entertainment, just silly. There will be great moments in the Africa Cup of Nations the more these teams play together and spend time together as the tournament progresses. But this is what you get when you say, oh, we really need them to stay for the big game between Chelsea and Liverpool on the 3rd of January. That's so important. And then on the 10th of January, having travelled to Africa and been through all the protocols and changed system and managers and teammates, of course they're not going to produce their best.
It's a fair point. I hadn't really thought, I have to be confessed, too much about the fact there's not even been one warm-up game. Obviously, you know, I know these players were playing in domestic leagues a week ago, but yeah, I mean, to not warm up, of course. It's disappointing for the tournament to not being given enough space, I suppose, for that little bit of preparation to happen. It's even the Euros this year, there was a limited prep, but there was still, I think, a 2-week period of warming up and gelling. And those warm-up games weren't great, actually, thinking back.
Well, the group stage games weren't great either. England scored twice in their three group matches.
Yeah.
You know, it happens.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, Scotland took a little bit of time to get going as well. It's true. I mean, and the Euros caught fire towards the end of the group stage and in the later rounds. Well, there's a bigger problem here, isn't it? The way this tournament's been moved around in the calendar in recent years, and you know, the overall kind of grudging acceptance, not but semi-acceptance from the European clubs to even release players. So that's all sort of a factor. I hope it just does start to open out in terms of goals and sort of entertainment.
One of the things for me when you look at this tournament is we see it so much through the prism of something that's an interruption, really, to our Premier League season and our viewing, and so many fans going, oh, blimmin' heck, we're going to be out without Mo Salah and Maxwell Cornet and all these kind of things. And that immediately gives it a slight negative slant, because as viewers of a tournament where we lots of us don't have an interest and we're able to watch it as neutrals, it doesn't give it that enjoyment slant of, say, watching the Champions League final when there are no English teams in it and you can just sit back and go, wow, this is great fun. And the other thing is that we're talking about it, that makes us talk about the big name players and things, but there are lots of other teams and players in there for whom this is a massive, massive deal. And this is an opportunity to put themselves on the international stage, players that have come from Africa and that are playing in smaller leagues, either in Africa or around Europe, and give themselves a chance to go on to a bigger and better career. We had a piece from a journalist who'd been in Sierra Leone and talked about the difficulties that players find to get an opportunity to make that big break. And it's centered around a guy called Muz Bundu, who's in the Sierra Leone team. And I watched him play the other day. He's got an absolutely wicked right foot on him in terms of crossing the ball. But for him, you know, he's grafted and scraped his way. He was actually in Craig Bellamy's academy that was set up in Sierra Leone quite a few years ago, and was signed by Vincent Kompany at Anderlecht, and is currently on loan in Denmark. But, you know, and then you go onto his social media and it's a massive deal. He is literally sharing everything from the tournament. It's so pure. And, you know, it's like nothing, none of the sanitized crap you get from England and everyone else when they're at tournaments. This guy is like sharing everything from his mates watching it on telly back home and like screenshotting it and going, go on, Muzz. And like for him and for loads of other players, this tournament should be a chance to, you know, represent your country, of which he and everyone else is incredibly proud of, but also to be on the international stage, to give yourself a chance. And I think when we have it, the tournament shrouded in debate around, oh, we're going to lose Mo Salah, and also these issues of refereeing incompetency, and it kind of taking that slight tone of, oh, what's the AFCON like, which is a little bit unsavoury for me, it just makes it such a shame for these other players, for whom there are loads and loads of them desperate to take their chance.
A lot of these referees, by the way, I mean, this referee had two World Cup games last time around.
Yeah, of course, that's the thing. Yeah,
an issue at the time. And there are FIFA referees across the tournament. So I don't think there's going to be a real widespread issue with the refereeing. It was just a one person's calamitous performance, I think. And as I say, I think the matches will improve as the tournament goes on, because there are some great sides. The interesting thing that I think we've almost missed in the debate about AFCON that I just finally wanted to point out was, you know, one of the things about the Africa Cup of Nations is it's every 2 years. And I was thinking, yeah, that is maybe something that they could change. And then I suddenly thought, well, hold on a minute, how many African nations get into the World Cup? And you think it's, what, five? Five? And maybe in the expanded World Cup that we're about to see, yeah, of course, it's going to be more. But, you know, half as many, or fewer than half as many as Europe gets. And you start to think, well, why shouldn't they have a tournament every 2 years if basically the World Cup they're excluded from, there's a huge continent of Africa, because they don't have as many places as they probably should, given the amount of nations that there are on their continent. So I think, look, AFCON will be good. I promise you. Those of you that are thinking, I'm not going to watch any more games, make sure you stay tuned. And do you know what? Maybe there'll be some good refereeing performances as well for you, because clearly that's what you watch the games for as well. Listen, talking about things improving, Chris Maguire, difficult situation for him at Sunderland. But on his return to the Stadium of Light for Tom's beloved Lincoln, he managed to score himself a hat-trick on the up and up. They beat 10-man Sunderland 3-1. And he decided that he would go over to the Sunderland boss Lee Johnson and give him a few choice words about releasing him at the end of last season. And he said, it was a build-up of things. I thought I was hard done by in my time here. It didn't really end the way I wanted to. I got a yellow card early on. I looked over. Lee Johnson was trying to get me sent off. I like this as well. I can't tell you what I said, but I did think I did my talking on the pitch. It was just a bit tongue-in-cheek after the last 6 months here. It ended badly for me. I hope the Sunderland fans are okay with me. I was getting booed, but I've got nothing but admiration and respect for them. I loved my time here. Tom?
What a day, Hugh. What a day. I don't even have to shoehorn Lincoln City into the game podcast. They're actually part of a genuine subject. Brilliant stuff. Yeah, I mean, this subject of old players haunting their old clubs is something that endlessly fascinates me, partly because of being a Lincoln fan. My dad has raised me as an utter pessimist. And one of the elements, as well as we're definitely going to concede from this corner every single time there's a corner, and we're definitely going to concede in the last minute, which often happens, is that every time he looks at a team sheet, oh, they've got X, Y, or Z who used to play for us, they'll definitely score. And just sitting, and it's almost worse when they do, just because he's going to go, told you. And I don't know whether it's just at a lower league level, Johnny, I don't know whether you have it with Aberdeen as well, but there seems to be this thing where fans are convinced, to the point where a friend of mine, Kenny, who's a Sunderland season ticket holder, messaged me before the game saying, really worried about Chris Maguire. And to give a bit of context, every Sunderland fan I know, he had this kind of quite a cult status with the club. He was known for his shockhousery, shall we call it, and his ability to be brilliant and infuriating in equal measure. And so when we signed him, I've got a couple of friends who are Sunderland fans. They said, he'll wind up opposition, you'll fall in love with him, he'll drive you mad, and he'll play a blinder every now and again. And so I replied to Kenny that he'd been basically rubbish all season and he had nothing to worry about. Promptly scores a hat-trick, of course. So there was his one blinder of the season. But I think, Johnny, you can talk a bit more about this because you mentioned it in your Times newsletter that goes out on Wednesdays, that it was so... I think we enjoy these moments even more so now because of the, you know, all the nonsense and the sanitised and boring celebrations that you see in football. So I think... You know, to see a bit of personality is a massive thing, isn't it?
Chris Maguire used to play for Aberdeen, and I remember him as a kid. He was exactly the player you described, Tom, but did have that spark of personality and could occasionally just lift the whole stadium and have that great performance. So I loved seeing the fact that he hasn't lost one bit of that. We've been talking a lot this year about players, the pathetically sanitised PR world that they try and enter when it comes to social media and the We Go Again tweets and all that kind of stuff. And we want players to be authentic, and we want them to reflect how we feel, which is, you know, when you do something good against a rival that annoys you or maybe somebody that put you down once in life, I think, you know, the Scottish sort of phrase is get it right up you. That's how we feel inside. That's how Chris Maguire, who's from Bells Hill, felt inside. I loved seeing it. I hate those players who, and it always seems to be like sort of slightly minor players scoring goals against teams that they once spent three games on loan. You forgot they even played for them, and then doing this kind of faux humble, but actually attention-seeking celebration where they show what a big guy they are by not celebrating. And I'd love the fact. Let's forget all of that. Going straight to the guy that kicked you out of the club you were enjoying being at to laugh in his face. Yeah, let's have more of that. That's how we know, that's how they're feeling inside. So, you know, show it.
Absolutely. And just while we're on the subject of showing emotion and brilliant reactions to performances and wins, Lincoln haven't been great this season. And to the point where, even though we've got an incredibly talented coach in Michael Appleton, some of the fans have even been questioning his position in recent weeks. We've had two wins, this big win against Sunderland. And so while we're on the subject of praising great reactions, Michael Appleton's wife, Jess, who is often on Twitter and is good value before games, kind of cheering on the lads, at full time, she just tweeted, Appleton out. And I thought that was so, so good. Such good value. So while we're on the subject of praising people for original and honest responses to football performances, I thought I'd give her a shout out.
Nothing's going to surpass Emmanuel Adebayor, is it, against Arsenal?
Yeah, the full-length pitch run is pretty good. And it was the slide on the knees as well.
In front of the Arsenal fans.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, yeah. No, I don't think anyone's going to risk a riot like that ever again. I do like the ones where you run up to the manager. You know, Lee Johnson got a red card at the end of that game, got involved with a scuffle, maybe just wanted to, you know, bite back a little bit. But obviously that can escalate. And I want it to be clever, well done, you know, whatever it might be. Mm. You know, like, for example, you know, the Sam Etu gets brought out a few times from the players that have been left the club because they're too old and they've gone back and scored, you know.
That was
I like that. I like that.
Yeah, well, you'll find a lot of personality in the lower leagues, and he's a player I've mentioned many, many times, but Kevin Ellison was always great, great value against former clubs. He played for Lincoln for a period, kind of a left wing back in an era under Keith Alexander and just afterwards, where we were quite successful, always failing in the playoffs, but then became a kind of journeyman striker. And every game, whether we were away or he was playing at Sinsel Bank, the fans gave him absolute dog's abuse, but in a very jokey, warm manner. And he always, always gave it back, but in a very, very good-humoured way, every single time. And always great value. I think you get more of that in the Football League than you do in the Premier League. But yeah, the Adebayor one in terms of the top top of the league, you can't go much better than that, can you?
No, absolutely not. Listen, before we go, one massive game to look forward to. There are a few big games, to be honest, in the Premier League this weekend. But there is a meeting of the top two that I mentioned a little bit earlier on. Chelsea go to Manchester City for the lunchtime kickoff on Saturday. Even if Liverpool win at home to Brentford, victory for City would see them extend their lead at the top to 11 points. So, if City win this weekend, is the Premier League's greatest ever race for the title between three incredible teams over before the end of January? Conceivably, yes. Johnny, what do you think?
Yes, probably. Yeah, because I was thinking, City have got to drop, what, they've got to mess up in four games now, four out of the last 16 or 17, which being Man City is hard to conceive. Straight away, and if this isn't one of them, then you start to wonder which games they might be. I think a draw would still keep things alive and let Liverpool close the gap. But yeah, I think so. Chelsea are in probably a slightly better place than they were when Man City came to Stamford Bridge, which is a brilliant game I was at. I think they might do something on Saturday. I'm going to the game and. Games between the top teams in the Premier League have been fantastic. Those top three have produced incredible games this year, all of them. And it's everyone's been a treat. So I'm really looking forward to Saturday.
I think Johnny could be right. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I keep predicting City. They'll have some kind of blip and I'm sticking to it. Like with all my other predictions, doubling down is the way these days. I think Chelsea could do something and blow this title race wide open. but you know, even a draw, I think it's still alive because I don't know, I just see a little stumble from City coming at some point because I don't think they're quite as faultless and as fluid as they have been in previous seasons. And I think the run they're on at the minute isn't as bulletproof as the run that they went on last season, shall we say. But very interested to see. It's not the game of the weekend, though, Hugh, is it? Let's be honest. Newcastle-Watford, come on. That is the one everyone's going to be tuning in for.
Yeah.
Chris Wood getting on the end of every... Kieran Trippier out of his feet, into the box. Chris Wood, hat-trick. It's game coming, isn't it? Surely.
I honestly think Watford are so bad that if Newcastle win this game and go level on points with Watford, that they will stay up on goal difference because Watford will lose that many matches every single game before the end of the season.
Put your money on now, ladies and gentlemen. We're only in January and Hugh Wozencroft is ready to call the relegation race and the title race
Newcastle
this weekend.
They're staying up, aren't they?
I mean...
I don't know why they've bought Chris Wood. I have to say, I've got absolutely no idea.
Because it weakens a rival. We've talked about this before. We both predicted
it,
I think.
But it's not for that reason.
We told them to go and get Sean Dyche and James Tarkowski. They just misheard and they went and get Chris Wood instead.
Listen, you're approaching, during this January transfer window, so many players of a certain level. We saw the Trippier signing. And we thought, that's the sort of name, that's the sort of quality player, an international who's played at Champions League football, who you think, right, upwardly mobile Newcastle are looking for players of a certain quality. And as a player looking on at that, I want to be involved in that squad if I believe myself to be a player of a certain quality. And then they signed Chris Wood. No disrespect to Chris Wood, a very solid Premier League forward. And does his job extremely well. We know what his job is, of course. It's not to be a massive goal scorer, let's be honest. He's not Thierry Henry, but he does have his use, of course, in the Premier League, and he's had a very good career. But if I'm a player looking on at that, I'm like, is that a championship signing? Is that a we might get relegated and we need to bring some players in who are going to get us straight back up? And I'd be wary then of signing for Newcastle.
Yeah, maybe, but I think it's also, let's be honest, if Wilson's fit, he starts and this is a good backup, isn't it? And so, and maybe as they progress and maybe sign more players, and if they stay up, as you say, there's a good plan B there from when Eddie Howe's playing his beautiful passing of football out from the back with all the lads and the pace down the wing and some guy up front that you've never heard of signed for 50 million. And then Chris Wood's a good plan B when it's not working. But I mean, Tony Cascarino has written this morning on the Times website that exact point, Hugh, that maybe there's a little bit of clever thinking here that if they do go down, Chris Wood will be an excellent, excellent signing in the Championship. I know that's not where the aspirations are, yeah, but it's no bad thing to be thinking that.
And they could sell him for 10 million, couldn't they?
I would have thought so. Yeah, coming to Middlesbrough any time in the next 18 months, I'd say. But yeah, I mean, look, if you're saying Newcastle are already up and you're saying the title race is maybe over, then maybe it's a good thing we've got the likes of Aston Villa and the most eagerly anticipated battle to finish 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th in the Premier League for the rest of the season.
We've got a very good weekend ahead of us.
We have.
There's Brighton versus Crystal Palace, yeah, as well. I think that one will be good. West Ham playing Leeds again. But listen, let's finally end with the predictions for those four games we mentioned. Aston Villa, Manchester United. Johnny, how do you think it's going to go?
Oh, I think Villa will win that one. They deserve to win the last one.
Tom?
2-2. Somehow United will get an own goal and a penalty to get a draw.
North London derby, Tom?
Arsenal.
Arsenal, away from home?
Yeah.
Johnny?
Spurs.
I like it. Authority.
Can I just say, you're doing your usual, Hugh, with Mr. Host, with me and Johnny. You've done it again. You've got to give your own prediction, man. Come on.
Aston Villa are going to beat Manchester United,
yep,
2-1. The North London derby will finish 2-1 to Tottenham Hotspur.
Right.
The next game we're going to choose is Newcastle against Watford. I think Newcastle will win that comfortably. 3-0.
Wow, big claim. I'm going to go 2-1 Newcastle.
Johnny?
Oh, I'll go in the middle, 2-0. I do think Newcastle will win.
And Manchester City against Chelsea. I think Manchester City are going to win this because they played so badly against Arsenal and Lightning doesn't seem to strike twice straight away with Manchester City. You either get them on a bad day or you've missed your opportunity because they bounce back pretty quickly. So I think City will win this. I think it's going to be a good game. I'm going to say 3-2.
Oh, God, that would be a right thriller, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You can tell you used to work in TV, Hugh, sometimes when you rev up these kind of matches. You should be doing the adverts for these matches on Sky. I'm going to go Tuchel Masterclass 2-0 Chelsea.
Johnny?
Oh, I think it'll be a connoisseur's 1-1. An absolute belter with not that many goals because they're both such good teams. But 1-1, and that is a slip up for Man City these days.
Johnny, I will see you at the Etihad. Okay, and I'm going to drag you onto the radio with me as well, so that we can make our debut on the airwaves. I'll see you there. Thank you all for listening. Okay. Tom Clark, Jonathan Northcroft. You can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism. If you sign up today, you get 1 month free. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.